Welcome to the Lifetime at Work podcast, episode 26, the podcast all about our jobs and why we do them, how we get the most out of them, and trying to figure out, are we in the right spot for us today? Each week, I interview a different guest about their job or about a topic related to the world of work. The goal is to help you learn more about your work life through the lens of someone else and just through discussion. I mean, thinking and talking about these things help, right? So this week, I'm talking to a legend of the law world. He's an M&A lawyer with a great wealth of experience, and I think we're ready to dive in here. So let's play the intro music and get going. Today, my guest is Bill Ainley. He worked about 40 years in the world of law, mostly corporate M&A law, but he was a defining person in a lot of respects. He joined a firm called Davies, which is now a lot bigger than it was when he initially joined, but became the head of M&A there. He was a pioneer in a bunch of different areas, and it was interesting. I mean, I've had a dialogue with him in the past for a bunch of different reasons over the last, call it 10 years, and I hadn't really heard the story and gone through the background and just sort of heard his perspective on his career, really. He's now retired, and it's interesting just to be able to now look back at that career that he had and what he did and what he loved and the opportunity that it gave him. I think one of the crucial and interesting things about this conversation is that he was at the same place and worked at the same law firm for so many years. His resume is very simple because he was just there all the time, but it was a lot more to it because he worked on so much and was just given so much, I think, autonomy and responsibility and just involved in a ton of different aspects of the firm as it grew to become just the reputable firm that it is today. So I'm hoping that this shines some light on what the career looks like in the long term for people as you think about it in terms of what you're doing and where you're headed and how you want to think back to your career when it's over. So here it is. I hope you enjoy this episode with Bill Ainley. Oh, Bill, welcome to the Lifetime at Work podcast.
Well, thank you, Greg.
I wanted to start, as I do with everyone, just with a quick background. I know sometimes it's hard, but maybe just the 2-minute kind of overview of yourself, and we will get into the details as we go.
Okay. So, I born and grew up in Montreal. Troubles in Montreal by the time I graduated high school. So I went to undergrad at Cambridge and I studied philosophy. Which is sort of a bit why I ultimately went into law, a couple of years at Cambridge, a couple of years at McGill, because I ended up in philosophy studying political philosophy and John Rawls, the theory of justice and the social contract theory of philosophy. So I kind of came into law, from the philosophical end of it. And when I, finished law school, I didn't particularly think I was going to practice law. Law seemed like a really good background degree to do many different kinds of careers or jobs. But then you start getting recruited if you do okay in law school. And, Montreal wasn't much of an option because my surname was Ainley, which in 1979 wasn't that popular in Montreal. So I came to article in Toronto at a firm called Davies Ward & Beck, now Davies Ward, Phillips & Weinberg. And the odd thing about me is I stayed there for 40 years. I retired a couple of years ago. At 40 years at the firm, I thought 40 years was enough for law. And then I joined the Origin Merchant Partners Advisory Board, which has been great. So that's sort of my background, sort of a one-trick pony, all law all the time. But law for me ended up, being super interesting. And the longer I was at it, the more interesting it got.
It was funny because I looked at your LinkedIn and I usually do a bit of research just to make sure I understand the background of whoever I'm interviewing. And yes, I saw that. It was just, you have LinkedIn doesn't, offers a lot of intrigue when you moved around, but you're like you said, you're kind of 40 years in the same place. And so it's made it got to peel the onion a little bit more here because there's a lot that sort of goes into it. But it's also really cool that I think you found one firm that you enjoyed, that you became a part of, that you lived your career through and went through. It just then, deserves then an explanation. So I'm curious how,
you know, why? Why did you ever feel that you wanted to leave and go do something else? Or what was it about that firm that made you stay for so long?
So great question. So when I started at Davies, there were 19 lawyers. And when I left, there were 245.
Yeah.
My professor of business associations at McGill, where I finished up my law, was actually, you know, from Western Canada. And he basically said the best firm in the country right now to do corporate law is a little firm, boutique tax and corporate called Davies. And there are a couple of lawyers there, you know, Gar Emerson and Howard Beck and you, Tom Allen, who are just like really outstanding, and it's small, and it just really appealed to me. And they gave me an offer to article there, and articling is pretty tough. You spend a lot of hours at it, and you make a ton of mistakes. But at the end of it, I was the only one of five that they rehired. I really liked a lot about the firm. It was set up very differently than most law firms. It was not at all eat what you kill. It was 100 team oriented. Their idea of what they wanted you to become a partner, you know, was about learning to be a good lawyer, was about learning to work well on team, to be creative, to be thoughtful, to be careful, you know, to put the client's interests sort of ahead of most else in your life. And I don't know, you know, I played a ton of hockey growing up. I believe in teamwork, and that just really appealed to me. It was an extraordinary firm. I became a non-equity partner after 2 years and a full equity partner after 5 years. They treated me like I was a fully fledged part of the team. You know, even by the time I was ending my articles, you know, teaching me how to bill clients and all kinds of stuff like that. And so I felt like I was part of a team, and they cared about me becoming a partner, not just getting a lot of hours out of me. The firm was pretty notorious for being a super hardworking firm. And there were times, you know, when I was working 80, 100 hours a week where I thought, this is ridiculous. But they always encouraged me to sort of speak up if there's something that just really wasn't working. And that made me feel that I wasn't working in a salt mine, that I was part of a team. I frequently, through sort of the first, first 20 years of my career, probably thought about doing other stuff. I did a ton of work, you know, for investment banks, you know, as a young lawyer in my first few years. And so, you know, I did a ton of work with Gordon Capital, with McLeod Young Weir, with Dominion Securities, with Nesbitt Thompson Bongard, or Nesbitt Burns as it became. And so I saw a ton of investment bankers. And of course, you know, there's a lot of law in doing an underwriting, or certainly was in those days before bought deals. And actually, for Gordon, I wrote the first underwriting agreement for a bought deal, taking out the market out clause. I love the firm's sort of attention to detail and excellence before everything else. Do a really good job for the clients, and you will do really well here. It was a very well-paid firm. So while a lot of people, you know, in the first few years of law were saying, this is ridiculous, I want to go and be a banker, or private equity hadn't really started then. This was back in the 80s. I was tempted, and, you know, I thought it'd be pretty cool, you know, to be at an investment bank. But what I liked is kind of the intellectual part of these transactions I was doing for bankers. You know, I did. They didn't do it. They weren't very interested in new creative solutions. They just wanted the answer. And so, I found it quite early on quite creative. Now, I'm not sure all law is, but I think when you're fairly near the top of the apex of an industry, that's where you get to do creative stuff. So the sort of long answer, I apologize, is yeah, often. I had friends that went and started little private equity shops later on at the firm, and friends at the firm that went to investment banks. I mean, Tom Milroy was a junior of mine, and he ended up, running BMO Investment Bank. you know, later on, Nigel Wright was a junior of mine for 10 years, and then he went to Onyx, and then he famously became Stephen Harper's chief of staff. Now he runs Onyx Europe in London. So, you know, we were surrounded by gold medalists, and as a team, we had the feeling that if you bring us the impossible, we will do it. It may just take a teeny bit longer than the conventional. But we believed that, you know, where you wanted to be is in the forefront of new developments, new creativity, new stuff, because obviously that's where you can charge the most. Once it's been done a few times, others can reverse engineer it, and then it becomes a bit more of a commodity and you get involved in more price competition. But when it's kind of one-off and it's not been done before, you've got quite a different sort of ability to bill. And, you know, I mean, there were decades in my career there, you know, where I was billing at about 150% of my time. The American Law magazine says the best firms in the States try to get to 85% of time. So it was a very cool place, which is why I stayed in many ways. But the other thing is, the longer you stay at law in a great shop, the more fun it gets, because you've got a whole bunch of really, really smart young people working on your deals with you. So I was running 6 deals at a time. They were doing like everything they could, and that tricky stuff came up to me and I made the call. And so, you know, you are empowered by that. And, you know, the other amazing thing that happened, you know, we were a relatively small firm, and we were acting across the table from big firms in New York and Toronto. And we used to worry about if we needed to sort of merge, you know, with a big New York firm in order to be relevant, you know, in a shrinking world with you know, capital being a critical requirement to business success. And then along came the internet. You know, my first 10 years of law, 15 years of law, the one, the internet. And it was just, it was a real marvelous thing for Davies, because all of a sudden people could do easy research and find out about us. And we started to become really well-known internationally. And my career, you know, I did, after sort of doing underwritings and securities, you know, I evolved into M&A. And you know, I don't mean so much private company M&A. I mean public company, public takeovers, and hostile takeovers. And that is very exciting work. And frankly, you know, I mean, iBankers do advise on that, but that's really a lawyer's, you know, field. And so I became well known in that. And, you know, I probably did 4 or 5 of the biggest transactions that were ever done in Canada. You know, I did for Xstrata when it took over Falconbridge, which took 18 months and was $22 billion, and became the chairman of Falconbridge after that because it had so much public debt outstanding. You know, I acted for BCE when private equity circled and, you know, the price was too high for the board to refuse. And, you know, we did sign up the agreement. And a year later, we were in front of the Supreme Court of Canada, who approved the memo that I had done to the board that said, if you pay all your contracts and you satisfy all your debts, all the premium goes to the shareholders, which, you know, the bondholders had contested all the way to the Supreme Court. So it was a firm that was a platform that you could take anywhere in the world. And, you know, I had clients in Melbourne, in Sydney, in Tokyo, in Hong Kong, in Poland, in Paris, in London, in New York. So it became a pretty amazing job. Long answer, short question.
No. Give me a bunch of things to follow up on. So the one I'm going to pick on to ask you about is, how much of it was, like, was a lot of the initiative, like, clearly you did a bunch of things new. You did a bunch of things that sounded like they were very, I don't know, call them cutting edge or just like, was it the firm that did that or pushed you to do that? Or was that you? And how did the firm like support you in that? I'm just sort of curious, just because, you know, in the traditional way, a lot of times firms are just the way they are. They have a strategy, they go ahead and they do it. Whereas, and maybe that was part of the strategy at Davies, but I'm just curious as to like the strategy of the firm versus, you know, the autonomy or the push that you had within it.
Well, you know, the couple of different answers to that. I mean, the firm always believed that you shouldn't curtail how far young people can go. You know, as long as they're, you know, roughly doing the kind of stuff you want the firm to do, then you should let them run with it and just say, you know, phone me whenever you got a problem. And so there was a tremendous sense of empowerment. You know, I closed an acquisition, you know, in Ottawa when I was an articling student. And I felt that there was no glass ceiling at the firm. And, you know, the partners, Garmson, Tom Allen, they'd take my calls any time of the day or night when I got to a point that I just couldn't do anymore. I mean, a great example of what you asked about is the Confederation Bridge, the bridge between New Brunswick and PEI. And, you know, the federal government had put this out to auction to build a bridge because they were losing so much money on the ferry service. And Gordon Capital had been approached by one of the principals of a Canadian sort of construction company to see if they could help him finance it so that he could put in a bid. They had sort of made it to the last round of three different consortia. And Gordon Capital said, you need a lawyer, not a banker right now. And the guy came over to see Tom Allen, you know, one of my seniors. And it was Friday afternoon and he had commitments. So I sat down with this guy and I had just been doing a whole bunch of sort of offerings for, like, you know, O&Y stuff where you just sort of securitize a government commitment to, you know, pay rent for a courthouse or things like that. And I basically took an offering memorandum for one of those deals and ran it up, you know, Friday night and sent it to the client, you know, on Saturday morning. And it was sort of a model for securitizing the government subsidy, which was going to be adjusted for CPP, was going to be zero pay for the first 5 years while you built the bridge, and then would kick in for 35 years until you had to give the bridge back to the government for a dollar, you know, in top shape. And I guess the guy was kind of blown away that he got it on Saturday morning. He could sort of understand a model for how to do his bid. And that was in late 1988. And financial closing was in 1993. And we won. But those 4 years, you know, were brutally hard work. And nobody had ever done a public-private infrastructure deal in Canada then. It was the first one that was ever done. It was about $1 billion. Our firm ultimately, after that, developed a huge infrastructure department, you know, a public-private partnership infrastructure group, and became very successful all over North America. I never did another one. You know, I just moved on to M&A. I was doing M&A before that. But David Peary, the client, I asked him. We became very, very close over the 4 years. And they're still a client of the firm, the PEI Bridge. But I asked him, like, why me? Like, what on earth? Why me? And he said, well, I had kind of figured out already, he had been a lawyer before he went into the construction business, that M&A lawyers are the most creative lawyers. And I knew I needed somebody super creative. And what you did that first night struck me as just the kind of guy I wanted. And I went with you because I had no idea where this was going to lead. So I needed somebody that was going to be really creative about figuring out. And, you know, there were like 700 closing documents. This is still the most complicated deal I ever did in my life. And I kind of thought, well, this is weird. It's taken me right out of Davies Ward's main wheelhouse, you know, public M&A. But some of the senior partners came to me and said, you know, you're famous all over the country now and you will just get calls. And that did turn out to be right. But you asked how the firm supported me. So I was 7-8 years out of bar, of being called to the bar. And eventually there were about 25 lawyers that worked on that file over those 4 years. You know, we had to change the constitution because PEI, in its terms of union with Canada, said continuous steamship service. We had to get 2, you know, 90-page tax rulings. We had to fight environmental litigation to the Supreme Court. I mean, so there I was, an 8-year lawyer, thinking this is really fucking scary. Sorry, I shouldn't swear on a podcast. But the firm was amazing. You know, I'm sure from the first few years they thought this bridge is never going to fly. But, you know, there were lawyers 20 years senior to me who were working on the file under, and I was running it. You know, everybody in the firm pitched in when I needed them, from senior litigators to the top tax partners, to, like, everybody pitched in, and I shouldn't have been running it. you know, senior people should have been running it, but nobody ever once said that to me. And I remember when it finally closed, I hadn't slept for about 3 days. And the client, you know, gave us $500,000 bonus on top of our time. And there was a massive distribution to the partners with a little note from the managing partner in the envelope that said, "God bless the bridge and all those who worked on it."
And what's funny or interesting to me is that it seems just the typical perspective I have on law firms and lawyers probably in general, like the typical is just that other people go and imagine things and then you come to the lawyers and they ground you and say, well, here's what you can do. Right. Like that's just the more, I don't know, that's just how you think about a lawyer, you know, right. more traditionally. But at the same time, there has to be lawyers that do the things that you otherwise wouldn't think you can do or help and support that. Is it the person in the firm, I guess? That was my question. It sounds like you just were at a firm that allowed that and it was maybe a perfect combination of you, the person and the firm allowing it versus another firm would probably have said, you know, or just not been in the ethos of how they think.
Well, I think, Greg, your observation is exactly right. It was among the seven sisters, you know, the top seven firms in the country, a completely different model. It was all about team. It was all about putting the client first and just being, you know, partners, being really good partners. I do not believe I would have stayed for 40 years in law at any other law firm in the country. It was so differently, you know, it was a relatively young firm then. As I said, it was only 19 lawyers. We were competing against much bigger firms, but the firm had a very unique sort of teamwork approach, that all my friends in other law firms said, yeah, it's not like that at this firm. And I'm not going to name names, yeah, but yeah. It was just really different. And Davies did, you know, change a little bit, you know, the culture of law firms in Toronto. I mean, you know, unfortunately, we were the first to have 3 8-hour shifts of secretarial support. So, you know, when we got instructions, we could give the draft agreement the next morning. And that kind of just bust open the competitive market in Toronto because that's not what the other six were doing.
Maybe it's a more broad question. You know, how is it different today?
Well, I mean, it's different. Well, especially post-COVID, it's very different. But you know, the technology has dramatically changed it, both in terms of, you know, being creative in coming up with the first ever deal of a kind. Technology lets other firms reverse engineer what you're doing, and you know, two deals later, they can produce something similar. So there is a true virtue at being at the very cutting edge of the development of new structures, new techniques, new products. And the firm always felt that that was the place to be. So they needed to pay more to hire gold medalists so they could go on being the most creative firm. And that to me was hugely important. But it was also, it was so weird because our clients were all extreme capitalists, but we were like a little socialist kind of firm on the prairie. Like it was all for one and one for all the time. And that just really meant something to me. So I think, to answer your question, it's still kind of the same. You can't go from a traditional law firm model of more or less eat what you kill. You know, you get paid according to how many hours you're billing and, you know, how much money you make for the firm. You can't really go to that from that to a all for one, one for all, we're a team approach. And you've got to start with that approach if you want to stick with it. And Davies started with that approach and they're still with it. And none of the other seven sisters have gone to that model. So it remains a bit of an outlier. But as Malcolm Gladwell said in his book by that name, outliers can sometimes finish way ahead of the pack.
Just taking a step back to what we were talking about before with the bridge, did you have kind of that imposter syndrome of kind of why me? And is this really, you know, am I going to screw it up because I've never done this before and everyone's relying on me? I mean, you can have those moments probably where you have extreme confidence and then other moments where you just are filled with doubt.
You're very astute. I didn't have very many moments where I was filled with confidence. You know, I guess I'm a bit of a type A personality, and a big aspect of that means fear of failure. So yeah, I thought I was an imposter more or less every day for my first 20 years of practice. You know, I did, I always remember Tom Allen, one of my great mentors. He sort of taught me to be a duck, you know, to be paddling furiously underwater, but to be real calm on top. And so, all the time, I thought I was an imposter, and I tried really hard to not screw it up.
Good. Well, I think, and did it, as you look back on that now, though, I mean, do you still feel that, or do you feel like, I don't know, what do you feel now?
Well, I guess it became harder and harder, you know, to conclude that I was a screw up that was an imposter, because eventually, you know, with the internet, I never learned how to market. You know, I just got calls. I just got emails. You don't know me, but so-and-so who you did a deal for 3 years ago said you were the guy I should use, you know, from all over the world. And so I began to realize that, I don't know, maybe I do know a couple of things. And, you know, maybe it's a personality thing, but like I kind of do okay when people can kind of give it to me and let me take charge. Yeah. And that's became a bit what my career was. I remember the largest copper mining company in Poland, and there's no company in Poland that has ever done a public takeover. And of course, their legal system is completely different. And out of the blue, courtesy of Rothschilds in Paris, I get a call. Rothschilds in Paris calls me and says, we have a client that wants to do a takeover in Canada. And, you know, they don't know how to do it. They've never done it. They don't understand Canada. They need somebody to kind of take control. And so you're the guy we recommended. And, you know, I spent 6 months with these Polish folks. I went over to Lubin in Lower Silesia 3 times. And, you know, they didn't know what to do. So literally, I ran everything for them. And, you know, there were investment bankers, European, but forgive me, they seem to be better at making dinner reservations than advice. And so, you know, it was sort of just an example of, I guess, a little bit why people ended up coming to me, because, you know, we would go into negotiations and I'd have 4 bankers on one side and 5 clients on the other side, and I'd be in the middle and nobody else would say a word for 3 hours. So I kind of like being a take charge guy. I was retained because I had that rep, and, you know, they never thought they'd get it for $15 a share. That was their opening bid, but we closed at $15 a share because I'm a hard ass.
Yeah. It's interesting. You said Rothschild called you. It's just because there's kind of no one else. There's like, well, we've done our research and we found that you're the guy, and it's probably a compliment being, well, at least, you know, there isn't someone else who, you know, you could point to or look to and say, hey, they know more, because you kind of are blazing the trail. And if not you, then sort of no one, and no real downside, I think, to
Greg, you know, I would say, you know, that there are always others. You know, there are a lot of lawyers in this country. And if you think there aren't fantastic lawyers at other firms, you're just being short-sighted.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's partly, you know, knowing the law really well. And it's partly just, you know, a sort of interpersonal thing. You know, if there are 5 great lawyers a client could choose, then choosing a lawyer that they actually kind of like and get on with, who kind of has some street smarts, who is kind of okay to talk to, you know, that becomes a differentiator. And, you know, I was never trying to get hired to do a trade. I was always trying to make a relationship. And I'm a great believer in business, in relationships. And, you know, we never did a ton of work, although we were successful initially. But, you know, when China was where all Canadian lawyers sort of wanted to be getting clients from, because the Chinese don't do relationships. You know, you do a great deal for them, they grind you on price, and the next time they do a deal, it's a jump ball between 5 firms, and they're going to choose the lowest price. And, you know, that's not the way I tried to do it. I tried to do it with relationships, so that, like I say, you know, I remember one retainer I got. I didn't really remember his name. And he said, you won't remember me, but I was a junior on this deal that we did in 1984 or something. And I watched it all. And I said, if I ever were a decision maker, you're the guy I'm going to call. So, you know, I think relationship is underestimated and really important.
How do law firms work? I'm assuming they're all structured similarly, but curious as to
how they work. They're actually not.
Okay.
And again, I think Davis was quite unique. You know, being a non-equity partner after 2 years is unheard of. Being an equity partner now, after 5 years, when I was totally unheard of. It's 12 at some firms now.
Okay.
So I never felt at the firm that I was, you know, a slave to a bunch of partners. I always felt we were a team. You know, I mean, in a really good hockey team, you got a first line, but you got a fourth line. You know, it takes a full team to win the Stanley Cup. And that's what I loved about Davies, that the partners were just as hard as the associates. I mean, it made me worry about what the future might be if I ever became a partner. But that was really big, that it wasn't an us and them. It was an us from the get-go.
But you don't have to name other firms in particular, but it sounds like that's not the norm per se. A lot of cases we're gonna grind you because we know you want to make partner. If you work hard enough, then maybe.
So, you know, it's not the norm. Now, I don't mean that there are not great law firms other than the one I worked at. There are. Absolutely, there are great law firms. And you know, two quite different models can, from different sides, come to quite similar products often. But no, I'm aware of no other firm that was structured and is structured the way my firm was. And I think it was the single biggest contributor to why I stayed so long. I just really believed in the model. And, you know, when I was a partner and I was the principal rainmaker in the firm for, you know, a decade, I tried to be exactly the way people had been when I was young. You know, I tried to always be available. I tried to work as hard as the young people. I mean, there was stuff that they were doing and stuff that I was doing on the file, and they were different. But, I never said, just work your asses off because I'm going to the country club.
So when you're recruiting young, I imagine it's hard to tell, right? Like, were you involved in that?
A ton. I remember introducing the current managing partner, Sarbjit Basra, to a tech client, which ended up being super successful. He sold his business after 8 years for 100 mil. But Mike asked Sarb at lunch, so why did you join Davies? And Saab said, because I had dinner with Bill and he talked about the firm and there was nowhere else that I wanted to go. So, you know, I really did believe in the model. And I really, you can't always communicate it because you're right. You know, you're recruiting and they kind of, they see your mouth moving, but they don't believe the words. And so you have to have a lot of pretty specific, pretty clear, you know, examples to convince them. But it was a very appealing model if you could properly communicate it to young people. And we were consistently hiring gold medalists, which does help with your ability to produce really creative, really smart work.
But how did you decide who to hire? What was your criteria? What would you look for in a young person that you would, you know, kind of know, hey, you're going to be good for our culture and our firm?
Well, you don't know. I mean, another great question, because you don't know.
Yeah.
For me, you know, I wanted to talk to them at length. You know, we had a system where you'd probably interview with six different people to get into the firm. It wasn't a one-to-one interview and out kind of thing. And so I was looking for somebody, you know, who had demonstrated an ability to be good at quite a few things by the time they were sitting in front of us. You know, they were not one-trick ponies, because I think that really contributes to creativity when you've actually experienced a lot of different things already in life. So, you know, obviously grades are super important because, you know, I mean, with one hand tied behind your back and blindfolded, you're still supposed to do really well in law school. But I was really interested in what else they had done, what else they were interested in, their ability to communicate, their ability to be simply engaging in a one-on-one situation. Because as I was saying before, you know, when you get called over to sort of meet a client or in a beauty contest or whatever it is, you've got to be engaging. You've got to not just say, I'm a smart lawyer. You've got to engage them. And that requires life experience and breadth and introspection and, you know, a lot of stuff.
And so it sounds hard work. It sounds like hard work to actually try to interview because you have to have a lengthy conversation with people. I find, you know, I do a lot of, as you know, I'm involved in a lot of the recruiting stuff that we do. And I find that in a lot of cases, people, the young people, they're trained. And it takes me a little bit. I have to try to break through that training and figure out who they are because they've been told how to answer. And you can kind of tell because I've sat there and listened to the same construction of an answer. And I have to say, okay, well, I'm trying to get at this. I'm trying to get at this. And some people you can, and you can kind of get in and they let you in, and others never do. And you'll spend 45 minutes with someone and then you just have to give up and say, all right, well, you're not going to give me anything to do it. So it's just it sounds like though, that's been the same with you.
I so agree with what you've just said. I remember poignantly Howard Beck, who was one of the named partners when I was an articling student. My parents had gone down from Montreal to visit the firm, and they happened to bump into Howard Beck, and they kind of gushed about, you know, how cool it was that I had this really great articling job. And Howard, I can't remember exactly why he said this, but I really remember him saying it. He said, well, recruiting is the single most important thing that anybody in this firm ever does. And I thought that was a really interesting answer. So you're right. It's hard to do. It's really hard to do well, but it's incredibly important to the future of an organization.
Taking a step back, maybe even to sort of where we started the conversation, you know, at a certain point you left Davies.
I retired.
What did that feel like, though? I mean, this was probably your identity. This is what you built the firm in a lot of ways. What was it like to leave?
I don't want this to sound vain, but after 40 years, I had done way more than I ever thought it could ever have been possible to do in law. I had friends and contacts and clients all over the world. And still, you know, 2 years later, when I travel, you know, they all still want to have lunch and see me and everything. Like, I formed really great relationships around the world. So I don't know. It was weird in one. So I say it that way because I'd done everything I wanted to do.
Yeah.
There were no big companies in Canada to take over anymore. I was just super lucky, you know, to be a young lawyer learning from masters in the first M&A boom, and then to in the next M&A boom to be a, you know, mid-level corporate lawyer kind of on his game. And then the third M&A boom, I was kind of, you know, one of the leading lawyers in all these sort of reviewing books like Chambers and stuff in Canada. So I kind of was very lucky at hitting the M&A booms at the right time. And so honestly, I just felt I've done everything you could ever possibly want to do in corporate law, and then sometimes 10. And so 40 years is good. It was never my identity, Greg, your phrase. My identity was always, I'm Bill. I'm Bill. And this is what I'm doing, and I'm doing it because I find it really intellectually interesting, and I'm working with a team of wonderful people where we each have each other's backs. We're not trying to put knives in each other's backs. And so, you know, I just felt it had been as full a career as one could possibly hope for. And, you know, 40 years was enough. I wanted to retire when I was still physically strong and active and healthy. I love sport. I love travel. I, you know, do tons of stuff. And I always wanted to stay healthy enough to enjoy it. So I just thought 40 years is good. I'm out. And I'm still really close to the firm. You know, I talk to the senior partners in the firm tons. Most of them were my juniors. Yeah. So what was different is, you know, when you're working in that kind of a career, you're getting emails and phone calls all the time. And sometimes you think, oh, Lord, could it just stop for a little bit?
Right.
And of course, you retire and it stops. And all of a sudden, you look at your phone and you say, I think my phone's broken. It just doesn't ring anymore.
Everyone got the message. Yeah.
Well, not everyone. You know, even 4 months ago, I had a call from a wonderful, wonderful client. He'd been the biggest individual shareholder of Canadian Pacific when it was taken over. Wonderful guy. But he called me up and said, Bill, how are you? And he said, his name, Jamie, said, I got a deal I really need you to do. And I said, Jamie, I sent a note around about 2 years ago saying I had retired. Oh, could you just do this deal? Well, Jamie, I kind of resigned my member in the law society, membership in the law society. Like, you know, I work for Origin Merchant now. You'll be startled to know I'm sort of a banker now. So I can recommend a lawyer to you. And so anyway, it didn't completely stop, but that was the biggest challenge. You know, for 40 years, everyone sort of seemed to want a piece of me all day, every day. And then all of a sudden, not so much at all. So yeah, that was a change. But other than that, no, because I never thought my identity was as a lawyer.
Did you feel like you had to, or what did you feel like you had to give up? Because, you know, working all the time, I struggle with that, of how, you know, you have goals and career goals that you're trying to do, and you have other things, friends and relationships and family that you're trying to do. Do you feel like you sacrificed things that as you look back?
Well, oddly enough, because that was a danger that lots of people would talk to you about when you were, you know, in those first 10 years of real grind in law. But oddly enough, I didn't feel I had to particularly. I have three wonderful grown children. I've just had my third grandchild born in Paris last night, Arthur. And you know, I talked.
Congrats! Yeah.
Thank you, Greg. I have two in Paris and one in Toronto. And two of my three kids, you know, one in London, one in Paris, and one in Toronto. So I'm off to Paris, as you can imagine, in a week. But I don't know. I would talk to them about it sometimes and say, "Do you feel I wasn't around enough?" And they all say, "No, Dad, you were around plenty, probably more than we wanted." you know, so I, you know, in back in the day, sort of in the 90s or whatever it was, people would talk about work-life balance, and I always thought it was a bit of a bad analysis because work is part of your life. So work is part of your life. You can't talk about a work-life balance because work is life. Yeah. So, you know, what was I going to do? Not work? That, you know, I didn't have that financial option. So I thought it was more important, you know, for the family to see into the work and into the work life. And so I tried to share a lot of what I was doing and why I might not be there one night or another night or a weekend, so that they sort of understood it. It wasn't just a black, you know, a black box. Yeah. And they all work really hard. All three of them work really hard without complaining a stitch. And I think that's the power of example. Yeah. So, you know, I always did a ton of sport, you know, until COVID, I was still ski racing, slalom and giant slalom, and I still do a ton of sport. I believe in sport. I don't believe that the body is separate from the mind. I believe the mind is a muscle like all the other muscles in your body. So I'm a great believer in, I guess it's from philosophy and the ancients, the Greeks, but, you know, healthy body, healthy mind, the mind actually is part of the body, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so, I'm much more integrated than the work-life balance analysis would imply.
Do you have goals for yourself now relating to career and work and that, or?
No, not so much.
Yeah.
Not so much. I mean, I don't want to be I don't want to be vain about it, but I feel like I had a big, you know, outsized kind of career all over the world. And, you know, I kind of just feel that I did a career, and I love to talk to people about deals. You know, I love being on the advisory board at Origin Merchant and trying to help with deals, but I don't feel sort of unfulfilled, and I still have to do something work-wise, particularly, you know, whenever there's a prize. I really like helping younger business people when they're starting out. And, you know, I tend to invest a little bit, but they call me and they talk to me, and about seven of them. And, you know, they don't pay me. I don't want to be paid. But I love the fact that I am being part of how they're trying to develop the business that they're starting. Yeah.
Do you have advice for young lawyers, or maybe even just young professionals? But I'm thinking more young lawyers, you know, early on in their careers today.
Well, so I'm sort of a believer in substance rather than marketing. And I don't mean that marketing is important. It is. But I believe that, the way it works best is if you put your head down and become really good professional at what you're doing, then you can lift up your head and start figuring out how to get that message out. And a lot of times, if you do the first part successfully, you don't have to do a lot of work on the second part because they find you and come to you.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think organizations, you know, generally in the financial services law kind of area, that focus on you need to build a book of business, you need to have relationship, you need to have clients, you need to get out and market. I think that's putting the cart before the horse a bit. I think first you got to become a really good professional, and then, you know, maybe you'll have to take your message out, or maybe you won't. Maybe they'll come to you. Unfortunately, I'm not, especially, for Origin Merchant, I'm not particularly good at marketing, because my way of marketing as a lawyer was to answer the phone when it rang.
Yeah. I hear you. No, I we're not looking to you for that. So it's more what to say once that phone gets answered. So Well, I appreciate it, Bill, and all your insights and to hear about some of the stories. Chatted a bunch of times. It's nice to spend a few minutes talking about the career. So really appreciate it, and thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Not at all, Greg. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for joining. I hope it makes you think a little bit about retirement and what work means to you today and the future. If you know anyone who might be interested in the podcast, whether as a listener or as a guest, please refer them to me. You can go to the website, lifetimeatwork.com, and find all the information you need. And until then, don't worry, be happy.